He was known as the Velvet Fog, a name that he worked hard to outgrow. Mel Torme made his first stage appearance at 4 and wrote his first hit song at 16. For more than 60 years, he entertained audiences with a voice that seemed incapable of making an unpleasant sound. I'm Fred Macy, and this is The Jazz Scene, dedicated to the preservation, promotion, and appreciation of jazz. A music critic once wrote, "Mel Torme works with the most beautiful voice a man is allowed to have, and he combines it with a flawless sense of pitch. As an improviser, he shames all but two or three other scat singers, and quite a few horn players as well." Singer Ethel Waters has said that Mel is the only white man she knows who sings with the soul of a black man. When I spoke with him a few years back, here's what he had to say.
"You've heard about Margie, heard about Dinah, heard about Susie. No maid has got a shade on sweet Georgia Brown. Big feet, so neat, sweet Georgia Brown. They sigh and want to die for sweet Georgia Brown. I'm telling you why."
Mel, it seems like the longer you sing, the better you get. It's true. How do you explain that?
Well, I guess it's a passage of time. I guess it's a practicing what you do on an almost continuous basis. I'm always singing. I'm always working. I work hard at trying to improve, and I hope I have improved.
When I hear your voice, I notice two things. Number one, I keep trying to say, who sounds like Mel Torme? And the reason I can't seem to find answers besides Stan Getz or Miles Davis is that you use your voice differently as opposed to having a singing style. You use it like an instrument.
Yeah, I guess I've always been thought of as a sort of an instrumental singer or whatever. And it's because growing up and learning how to sing and listening to the people that I enjoyed, my greatest influences were the Stan Getzes and Miles Davises and George Shearings and Jerry Mulligans and Benny Goodmans. I mean, I can go on and on and on of the world, not necessarily the singers, although, of course, I admire an enormous amount of singers. But as I said, my great influence were the instrumentalists, and I suppose that's why it turned out the way it did.
People used to call you the Velvet Fog. I'm not sure where that came from, but you no longer sing the way you used to sing. Quite differently. Is that by design, or did nature help you take care of that?
It's probably a little bit of both. I think nature, from a standpoint of growing older and voice getting deeper, had a lot to do with it. But I consciously also turned a corner, you know, turned a switch, whatever you want to call it, and decided that the kind of singing I was doing from approximately 1947 to about 1955, when I really broke out of the shell of sort of creamy Bobby Sox teen idol pop singing and did what I really wanted to do in the first place, which was investigate the jazz idiom, that was, I guess, the turnaround, the turning point for me, and I've really kind of never looked back.
Speaking of the jazz end of things, you have a great association, particularly in a recording sense, I guess, with George Shearing. Tell me about the Shearing connection, how that happened.
That happened out of a concert that George and I did in 1977 at Carnegie Hall. George Ween, who was the entrepreneur of at that point it was called the Newport Jazz Festival, decided to put George and myself, and Jerry Mulligan, by the way, together in a concert. And it seemed to be something of a landmark concert. People really seemed to love it. We got blindingly good reviews on it. So we started doing Carnegie Hall together every year, and then branched from that into other concerts and even hotel dates at the Fairmont Hotel San Francisco and Chicago, all over the country. Now Georgie and I were doing the Berlin Jazz Festival on the 4th of, or the 2nd, I take it back, 2nd of November. Next year we're flying, believe it or not, for literally two nights to New Zealand to do the first New Zealand Jazz Festival for, I think, American Express sponsors that. And so we're still very, very much involved professionally as well as personally. We're great friends together.
I was going to ask if you were actually friends or if it was just a good business association.
No, we're great friends.
Does the name Coon Sanders Orchestra mean anything to you?
Well, it means everything to me because it was the beginning, literally, of my career, I mean, people kind of raise their eyebrows when I tell them that I was singing for money professionally with Coon Sanders Orchestra, a very famous band of their time, in Chicago at the Black Hawk Restaurant in 1929. I was 4 years old. And again, I've never been out of the business since that very first foray into show business at that tender age.
You've been able to adapt very nicely to each generation as it came up, where a lot of singers sort of fall by the wayside. What would you attribute your ability to adapt? Obviously, you're singing new songs, but you haven't, you know, gotten plastic and overly pop about it. You're doing, it seems, what you want to do.
I've really always done that. On a couple of occasions, I made the grave mistake of making deals with large record companies, the big majors, and they were very dictatorial, almost tyrannical about, hey, don't be a wise squirt. You do what we tell you. We know better than you. Well, they don't know better than me. They don't know better than anybody who sings and who has a long litany of songs and a history of experience behind them in the business. They really don't. You're dealing with accountants, you're dealing with lawyers, and I don't really want to get into that end of it because we haven't got time for it today. That's a whole program in itself.
Yeah, I bet.
But the truth of the matter is that principally I've always sung what I felt I could be credible with, and I think that that's contributed to my longevity in the business. From a standpoint of adapting to modes, I think the best thing that ever happened to me was what I mentioned just a few moments ago. The fact that I did not languish in the pop category, because so many pop singers that I really like enormously, and still do, have really kind of fallen by the wayside from a standpoint of being current on record. An awful lot of great artists, great singers, have one terrible time trying to get a record deal now. But my having moved over into the jazz category, jazz seems to be timeless and ageless, and I'm very grateful for that, and I'm grateful for the fact that I've been accepted in that family of jazz performers, because jazz artists like Ella and Sarah Vaughan, Joe Williams, just go on and on and on, and I'm praying to God that I will be part of that that conscience in the public's mind, that consciousness, I should say.
What is ahead? What would you like to do next if you could pick a project?
Well, there are about 8 projects going right now, and I don't really know which one we're going to attack first. I'm writing a book on Buddy Rich, and there are about 28, 29 chapters done on that.
So you're a drummer, too, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah.
And a pianist, and a composer, and a whoo.
Well, yeah, I'm going to do them all till I get them right. I'm doing that. There's a Broadway show in the offing that I can do if I want to. I'm just really kind of mulling that possibility right now. I don't even know.
That'd be a different approach for you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I've never done Broadway. It's really the only area that I've never in which I've never performed. So that's a possibility. And then, of course, there's the Hollywood Bowl again for the 14th year now. This coming year will be the 14th consecutive year at the Hollywood Bowl. And this time, once again, it's with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, 2 nights with them. And hopefully, I guess, Carnegie Hall again. Again, that'll be my 14th year.
You're awfully busy. Do you get time to relax?
Well...
Or are you a workaholic?
Not a lot. I mean, people say to me, where do you take your vacations? I tell them my home address. I say I take my vacations in my house. But I travel a great deal, and I'm not complaining about it. God and the business and the public have been very good to me.
You kind of like to sing, don't you?
You bet your life,
yeah.
I do.
Nightingale sang in Berkeley.
Torme. I had the pleasure of getting to know Mel a little when I was at the talk station in New York, and he would come in to guest on one program or another. And since my studio was the only one in the entire of the 22nd and 23rd floors that we occupied, which allowed smoking, well, he used to come in and hang out, help contribute to my infamous blue cloud of smog in there. It's sort of a break in a pair of crazy schedules for the both of us, anyway. Well, I'd like to think that he enjoyed some of our conversations as much as I did. He's a fascinating man. Although Mel spent most of his career as a singer, he was also a drummer, pianist, musical arranger, actor, author, and a prolific songwriter. Probably his most famous composition was the Christmas song, you know, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, recorded internationally in more than 1,734 versions. Yeah, that one. In fact, he liked to recall how he and his frequent lyricist, Bob Wills, wrote that song on a sweltering summer day in Los Angeles. He saw a spiral pad on his piano, had four lines written in pencil. Chestnuts roasting, Jack Frost nipping, Yuletide carols, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Mel wrote some of the lyrics and the music. Bob wrote more lyrics, and 40 minutes later, they had a timeless classic. See, the logic here was that if they could immerse themselves in winter, they'd cool off. Now, that's pretty cool.
Now I've met Miss Jones, and we'll go on meeting till we die. Miss Jones and I.
Say, I'd like to thank you for spending some time here with us at the Mark of Jazz, and I hope you've enjoyed our little chat with Mel Torme as much as I've enjoyed sharing it with you. If you'd like to hear something special, or want to talk about the things you like best, just leave me a comment here at the Jazz Scene or on the website itself, markofjazz.com. Until next time, let me remind you of some sage advice from Miles Davis. Don't play what's there, play what's not there.
Now I've met Miss Jones, and I want to know the reason why. And we'll go on meeting till we die, Miss Jones and I.